Professors FM.
Analytics with Mike Lewis, the podcast where we talk about everything you need to know about sports analytics. Here's your host, Mike Lewis, marketing professor at Emory University.
Okay, welcome everyone. Welcome to a special edition of the Fanalytics podcast, a special edition because it's a deep dive into some entertainment programming rather than sports. And today's topic, well, actually, before I get to today's topic, my name is Mike Lewis. I'm joined by Doug Battle. And today we have a special guest, Sayun Kim, a professor of marketing at Georgetown University. Hi, Sayun.
Hi. Thanks for the invite.
Okay, now we've dragged Sayun into this because our topic for today is the biggest show in Netflix history, that is Squid Games. And I wanted to drag Sayun's a professor of marketing. She's interested in topics like fandom and, you know, all sorts of stuff that's related. But I wanted to include someone actually from Korea in terms of this discussion because there's certain parts of this, you know, and again, We're gonna look. There's gonna be some spoilers in this. We'll try and sort of gentle spoilers, but the biggest show in Netflix history is set in Korea, and it's enmeshed in terms of Korean culture. So Sayun has seen the show, and we're hoping that she can help us out with some of it. As a starting point, like I said, Squid Games came out this last September. It has appeared in over, Netflix has put it out there in 94 different countries, 142 million, well, I'm looking up a number here, attracting more than 142 million member households during its first 4 weeks from launch, okay? Surpassing 2020's Bridgerton, which I guess was the previous Netflix winner. It is in pre-production for season number two, beginning in November 2021. So I think this was a relatively small show that absolutely blew up. Okay, now we are all friends here. Doug and Sayun, maybe we'll lead off with Doug. What did you guys think of the show?
Yeah, I started and finished it last week, so it's a pretty quick watch. You know, starting out, I was thinking, the last Netflix show that I watched simply because everybody was talking about it was Stranger Things. And I was like, this looks stupid. It's going to be about monsters and stuff. And then, of course, I ended up hooked on it and I'm still a huge fan. And so I was like, well, maybe that'll happen with this. And so we're in the first episode and I'm thinking, okay, maybe this is like Hunger Games, like Korean version. It could be kind of cool. And then the bloodshed starts. And oh my word, I think I'm scarred for life.
Okay. And so I'm going to say Doug Battle has mixed feelings about Squid Games as we go into this. Sayun, yeah,
Also, I do think it's singular. I don't think it's plural. I think it's Squid Game.
Okay. No, I think you're exactly right. Squid Game. Sayun, what did you think of it?
Well, first, when it came out, I wasn't that interested. But then my friends were all texting me whenever I go out and meet people. They were like, have you watched this? And then I'm like, no. And then that was kind of embarrassing. So I had to watch it because I am from Korea. And then I was like, okay, what's so like hip about this? Like, what's so like fun, like interesting about this? And while like, as I watched the show, I'm like, okay, it's pretty violent, which I don't like, but I could not stop watching it. So like I had to watch it in like literally like overnight. I could not stop binge watching it. So that was my reaction to it. And then what I really liked it about was the color scheme and the music that kind of contrasts with all the violence that's in the show. So yeah, overall, I liked it.
Okay, and I'll add to that. I think we all have, and look, maybe we're not the, well, Doug, you're probably dead on in terms of their target audience, sort of your age range in terms of being a prime Netflix customer. Sayun and I, you know, university professors, maybe we're not totally in their target audience. I had mixed feelings about it as well. There's a lot that's compelling about it. I didn't need 9 episodes. So if there's one other observation to make at this point, is that I think we all kind of got dragged into it in different ways. And I think this is always a lesson in fandom, that we got sort of dragged into it via the hype. Then I think Doug just got dragged into it as part of his job, which is kind of funny to me.
I have one more thing to add. I have one more thing to add as far as my review of it somewhat. I actually feel like the show is well done. Like, I think it achieved what it wanted to achieve. It was disturbing when it wanted to be disturbing. It roped everyone in with I think the acting was phenomenal. So I think, like, as a piece of art, it actually was very good and successful. What is just so curious to me is that it's consumed or marketed as this, like, another fun Netflix show to watch. It is not a fun watch. Like, it's not, you don't sit there and have fun. You sit there and you're just like, oh gosh. And yeah, it makes a point and it's great acting and it's the visuals and the audio, like she was saying, are, you know, I think everything is purposeful and excellent artwork, but all the memes and stuff make you feel like I said, it's going to be Stranger Things. It's going to be fun. It's going to be a fun show to watch with friends and stuff. And it's just like she was saying earlier, I don't know how this became so popular.
Well, I mean, you know, in terms of like the, call it the network effects, in terms of the hype building, all of my kids watched it, you know, from my 17-year-old daughter to my 23-year-old son. I heard about it from other Korean PhD students that I have. You know, the hype just kept building. I mean, Doug, you must have heard about it from just about everyone in your age cohort, right? I mean, this was had as much hype as like Tiger King.
Well, I mean, they had like the SNL skits and everything. Okay. It was that level of phenomenon.
Okay, now, you guys have alluded to the fact that this, in some ways, is not a fun watch. It's not a lighthearted watch, despite some of the, I also want to say sort of cartoonish or comic book colors and imagery that's, you know, on the set design. This show falls into this category of what I would call survival games, right? And I think this is almost kind of I suspect this is a universal trait, right? I mean, you know, as a kid, in America, you know, you play games that are some variant of King of the Hill, right? Which tends to be a bunch of people trying to smash each other on the playground with someone trying to make it to the top. And this idea of a survival game has become pretty prominent in entertainment. The one that I think of as the prototype is Survivor. I think Survivor is now on its 40-something season. When it initially came out, and again, you know, age helps on some of these things. Survivor was an enormous thing with network TV covering whoever was voted off the night before, with that person going on the Today Show and really making the rounds. I think beyond that, there's all sorts of variants of the Survivor game. We've got things like Big Brother, The Bachelor. I think Doug mentioned The Hunger Games. Again, another one of these kind of, you know, you start out with a big group and you whittle your way down to one. So, I mean, my question to you guys is, do you guys watch any of these Survivor game type programs? And if so, you know, what do you like about them? Sayun.
So I watched Hunger Games, and in Korea, there are a lot of survival shows, and I am pretty used to like watching all those. And what's fun about that is that when you watch it with like other people, then you can talk about it and then you can share your emotions, your feelings, and then like your comments with them, right? And then I think that really makes you like to like really get into this thing. So that was one thing that I thought. And then,
is this a bigger genre in Korea than it is in the States?
Yes. No. So here you guys also have something like American Idol, right? So that there are a lot of like entertain, like feeling my age.
But I think it's a good point. And again, you know, Doug, you grew up in this era, but Yeah. And before Survivor, this kind of reality TV show votes someone off every week, this doesn't happen. And when Cy Young mentions American Idol, or what's that one with the where they dance? Something called The Voice. I mean, I haven't even seen most of these shows, but I do suspect
Dancing
they're everywhere.
Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah. Like The Next Top Model, like all that like kind of shows I thought was like pretty similar. Those were reality shows, but this one goes into this like movie genre, but still very similar.
Doug, you're a big fan of The Bachelor, right? Or The Bachelorette?
Yeah, big Bachelor guy. Big Bachelor guy. I've been watching for 20 years now. And I'm waiting for the Bachelor Squid Games crossover.
Oh, beautiful.
Where, yeah, you know where it's going with that. Dark humor. But no, so I think the closest thing I watch to Squid Game is football, because you got guys just about hospitalizing each other out there in a competition to survive over the course of the season and see who ends up, you know, as the one team that hasn't lost. But I think with competition games, like competition entertainment, the stakes are always what pulls you in. I remember as a child watching Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and it's like, wow, there's $1 million on the line. This is pretty huge. And so I think what Squid Game did was take it to the furthest step and have the highest stakes possible, as far as what do you lose if you lose your life? Like, that's straight up. There's no, that doesn't happen in The Bachelor. That doesn't happen in America's Next Top Model or Dancing with the Stars. And it makes me think about, you know, if I'm really bad at something, like if I'm playing cornhole, I'll tell someone, like, you could hold a gun to my head and I still wouldn't be able to hit the board. You hear people say stuff like that all the time. Or I still wouldn't be able to remember the name of the person I just met. But, you know, Squid Game took that very literally and said, okay, let's put a gun to their heads and see how they perform with the highest stakes possible.
Well, that's interesting to me, because I think back to when they initially talked about Survivor, and, you know, there was a lot of discussion, a lot of hype about this new game show, Survivor, before it came out. And the way it was always positioned was, they're basically going to drop people off on this island with basically no food or shelter and see who makes it to the end. So, you know, going into this, you really almost had this image of, are people going to die on the set?
I know, I was going to ask, do people die?
Yeah. Do people die? That. Are they going to medevac people out of there? and obviously not. I mean, I would guess that there's been, with 40 plus seasons, there have probably been some serious injuries or, you know, medical issues on Survivor. I don't think there are any real casualties. I suppose it's an interesting commentary that when we think about some of these shows, they end up being relatively safe, the real ones, but when these are fictionalized and we move to things like Hunger Games and Squid Game, that when the screenwriters take control and they move to what people maybe really want, we do have a lot of death.
Yeah, a lot of death, which is disturbing to watch, and also makes you, I don't know, it's like, I feel like it's very desensitizing to watch over the course of a season. You become very numb to the loss of human life.
Yeah,
and especially they're like playing like games for like little kids, right? So that even contrasts more.
I do love, my favorite thing, Soo Young touched on this earlier, but the music that's like, it's disturbing, like almost, I don't know how to describe it. It's, there's something about it that just makes you, it's like clowns, like you, like how they're kind of disturbing. It's the audio form of a clown, and it makes you uneasy. It's unsettling.
Well, you know, let me follow up with you on that, because I'll be honest with you guys, I didn't notice the music. So, but I do remember a lot of the, and some of this is beyond me. You know, in some ways, Squid Game felt a lot like a high school English teacher's dream, where there's a lot of symbolism and there's a lot of foreshadowing. You know, for example, whenever they walk to an event, to a game, they're walking through this strange kind of series of brightly colored stairs and almost looks like a Lego set. And I kept thinking, this probably means something. Yeah, pink or baby blue. And I suppose, were they playing music during those walks?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Same song every single time.
Okay. And so then I'm thinking, it's like, There was probably something meant by that, or was supposed to symbolize something, but I have no idea what.
I can't like recall the name of the thing, but there used to be like this thing you play during your music class when I was really young. Like
based recorder. On her hand gesture, it looks like a recorder.
Yes, 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 exactly. So like there is a sound, like recorder sound. So that what I thought was like very like disturbing and but interesting at the same time.
Well, let's stay there, because I mean, what I want to do is sort of break down, and again, with sort of light spoilers, break down how this show works. And I think you guys are starting to touch on one of the themes that I wrote down during my watch, which is a lot of playing up of nostalgia. You know, and so a lot of childlike imagery here, right? I mean, and that is something that will almost always sell in entertainment, is bringing people back to their youth or bringing people back to their teenage years. And you know, maybe this is more of a question to start with Sayun. This was laden with Korean nostalgia, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a lot, actually. And then I did not even like, I don't know. So what was like shocking and like interesting to me was that for Korean shows to like succeed like in the world, like outside Korea, I thought you had to kind of like modify some like the version of like Korean taste. But what they did in the Squid Game is they literally brought what I did when I was a little kid, what I used to play to the like a show, and then it was really, really Korean, and then that worked out. So I thought it was fun. And then another thing was that...
Well, I think I have to ask you this question directly. Do Korean kids play Squid Game on their playgrounds?
So I actually never played it, but there are like similar versions of those games. So like really like little kids, like in the playground, they'll do something like that.
Okay, so this is a real thing.
It is a real thing.
Okay.
I think it's like if they made an American version, which I'm sure they will, because it's a money grab, they would do like hopscotch or, I don't know, dodgeball or something, stuff that we played growing up. But I assumed watching it, it was like, these are probably common games, even though they're pretty unfamiliar to a lot of U.S. viewers.
Oh, I mean, some of the games were... It was kind of great. I mean, it's again with this backdrop of trying to figure out, is this sort of a nostalgia play for the Korean audience? Some of the games seem kind of crazy to me, Sayun. Like there's the
like
game.
What? We don't have that glass thingy that no. in real life. Just to make sure.
I was thinking of the game where they were literally throwing pieces of paper on top of other pieces of paper, trying to flip them over.
That is real. I think like my little brother used to play all the time when he was like 6, 7. Like that is real actually, but we don't slap each other, so just to make sure kids don't do that.
I do think that they probably were strategic in the order of the games, because the very first game that's played is as a competition is Red Light Green Light, which is the one game out of the entire show that was familiar to me, an American. So I feel like they maybe roped in a wider audience in that first episode and then kind of funneled them in to the more Korean games throughout the series.
Yeah, I wish I knew the answer to whether what the play was. If this was designed for an international audience or if this was designed for a...
If it was just kind of an accident.
Yeah, if it was an accident. I mean, from watching the show, Sayun, could you tell? Is this very much kind of what Korean shows look like? Or does this seem like something that was adapted for something beyond the Korean audience?
It was very, very Korean. So I'm not sure the director literally like did this like purposely.
I'm going to... My argument here, as an American person that's never stepped foot in Korea, is going to be that it was made for a Korean audience and kind of stumbled upon the success that it's had, because here's my thought. the white characters in the show that come in with the masks are complete caricatures of rich white people. They're not, they're like, you know what I'm talking about? And I'm like, it was kind of, I don't know, you know, it's not like I'm offended by it or whatnot, but it's not like, it wasn't, didn't feel like real life portrayals. And it was intentional in that, I think. It was supposed to be kind of a satire. But the white acting and the way white people were presented to me didn't seem like they were really trying to appeal to a white audience or I need to
apologize for that.
No need to apologize. Trust me, white people have been doing that for years in their movies with stereotypes.
You know, the other fun part about this is, and so at some point in the show there are a number of people that show up. I don't know if they were all white. I think the majority of them were white, and they're really, really creeps, really beyond being creeps.
Yeah.
But they show up wearing kind of these crazy animal masks that are kind of glittery, metallic animal masks. And I think I actually texted Sayun while I was watching it saying, what's with the mask? Is this a thing? And I think your answer was, no, this is just weird, right?
But then in the show, everyone except for the participants were wearing those masks, yeah. Right? Some sort of mask. So I think they didn't
again,
want
like
to.
Like I said, this is something for that high school literature teacher, some sort of symbolism that means something deep, I'm sure.
I know, like bunny mask or whatever.
My non-English interpretation is that this is clearly a cult. And it had all the makings of a cult. They have their own little like government system, and they have their little rules that they follow. I mean, they followed it like it was religion. They acted like it was democratic and fair to everyone. They had the participants' best interest in mind, even though they were killing them off in mass genocide. I just saw it as a cult, and that was part of their cultish tradition. Was these kind of godlike. In their heads, they're like these deities, and they wear these masks that make them into kind of above human level.
Okay, so the other thing about Squid Game and why I wanted to bring this into our context, our podcast, is like fandom is real in entertainment. It's a little bit different than sports fandom, but some of these entertainment programs like Survivor. You know, the connection to, or the similarity to sports is a little bit more, it's a little bit more direct, right? I mean, you know, one of the reasons that people say they like sports, and again, some of this is kind of up for debate what the right level of this is this idea of uncertainty. And so the Squid Game, like Survivor, like The Bachelor, like I assume, American Idol or The Dancing Show, all these things, have some level of competition and you don't know who's going to win. Okay, so for Squid Game, is that an important part of the story for you guys?
For me, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, for me, it was more like who is not going to die, because towards the end, I'm like, please don't die. This like character, I really like this person. Please don't die. It was more of that.
I will say this, though, one similarity to sports, and this is as a longtime sports fan, is that the way the games unfolded for a large majority of the characters was in no way favorable to what you wanted. It wasn't what you wanted or what your expectations might be for this fairy tale ending of your favorite characters coming together and overcoming. It's like stuff just happens, and sometimes you have a favorite character and like you have to watch him get murdered right in front of you. I've had that experience as a sports fan many times over the course of my life.
You know what, that's kind of an interesting point of differentiation, right? That usually in sports, there's some glory for someone. And I think most of these shows, there's some glory, right? When, you know, you win Survivor, you get to, I don't know, propose and have a marriage proposal accepted on The Bachelor.
I think that's The Bachelor. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think there's any, this one didn't feel like there was much glory in the way of, but competition is the background. So that's kind of the foundation. Now, I think where you guys are both sort of going with some of this is, you know, when I think about these shows, and look, this is one of the beauty of sports or competition, and Doug and I actually talk a lot about this, how sports has a real ability to create narratives. you know, week in, week out, as seasons progress, as games progress, the storylines just form. Like, you know, the Olympics is really known for this. We're going to have the Winter Olympics in a couple of months. You will start to see the media introduce key athletes. And when you get to the Olympics, they'll start to do the backstories and they're overcoming adversity. Squid Game takes this level of competition, you know, this kind of uncertainty, this kind of thrill, and then layers stories about the human condition one on top of another, on top of another, on top of another. What about that, you know, and again, it's tough with the idea of not, I mean, it's kind of funny that we're trying to avoid spoilers, given that we're probably the last three people in North America that are going to watch this show. But, you know, if our audience is looking for something to binge and they want to get into this, you know, we're sort of given a roadmap. How did you guys view the human nature stories in this? And it might be a tough question to ask because that's really what it was built on every character. You know, Doug, what did you think?
I thought it was brutal, you know. I thought it was kind of Darwinistic. And you mentioned earlier that there's no glory, really, in winning, unlike sports. And unlike even the Hunger Games, it feels like there's this, like, oh, we beat the bad guys, or, you know, we made it out. But it was just kind of empty and brutal, and survival, I mean, was all that mattered. You saw the selfishness of people and the fact that at the end of the day, no matter if someone's friends or friendly or whatnot, they tend to look out for themselves above anybody else. That was kind of one of the themes. Of course, not every character was that way, but, you know, I thought it opened itself up to interpretation, and we've seen some commentary, some journalists that have taken it and said, this was a criticism of people in the US. This was a criticism of capitalism. This was a criticism of America or whatnot. I don't necessarily think that's the case, but I'm saying that the condition, it's such an underlying theme that it's like it could almost be applied to any group of people and say, oh, this is a criticism of them, because ultimately it was just a reflection of the way the writers think that human nature plays out, with stakes being life or death.
You know, I wrote down the words I wrote down in my notes was that so much of it was motivated by trauma and greed, that almost every character's backstory was driven by either some terrible event that happened to them and them reacting to it, or just out and out greed, whether they're a criminal or a gambler or a financier. And probably from that starting point, it probably does lend itself to these interpretations that you're talking about, Doug, this idea of, oh, look, you know, there's people that have a lot and there's people that have nothing. So this right. is a reflection of, and I don't know, Cy Young, what do you think about that? That there's this TV show set in Korea about a bunch of Koreans in this horrible situation. And the first thing Americans do is say, this is about us. Hey, please.
I think it wasn't for American. It was like,
yeah. I agree.
But what I heard is that so the director actually wanted to make this show like 10 years ago, but then he wasn't able to get funded and the investments and things like that. So it didn't work out. And then 10 years ago in Korea, people said it's not going to work out. But then later on, this happens to him. So I think it wasn't for like criticizing Americans, because like, wherever you go, like in every society, there are some issues and problems, right? Mm-hmm. So I think the director was just trying to like show some problems that exist in Korea, but right. then that applies everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, and like, so you had what, someone trying to smuggle themselves and their family in from North Korea. You had foreign workers coming in. You had gambling. So I would guess that these are kind of universal. These are universal issues. You just change a few of the details.
I found it humorous reading some of the reviews and write ups on it, because there were some, I guess, interpretations that made it seem like the reviewers are interpreting everything through as if the show were written specifically for this political climate in America. Whereas, you know, I would imagine written by people in South Korea that there's a whole another world of issues that are probably, if anything's being criticized, it would probably be more likely to be those.
Well, Sohyeon, what's the reaction within Korea to, or the interpretation of the Squid Game in Korea?
So you mean like, can you?
Well, so I think, you know, what Doug is saying is in America, every time we see something now, people basically start with their political agenda and they fit whatever the event is to prove a point about their political agenda. So is there something similar that goes on with Korea with the Squid Game, that this is an attack on income inequality in Korea or the lack of, you know, whatever the issue of the day is?
Well, I think it's not like about political issues in Korea, because it already had like a lot of like lessons, I would say. I don't know how to put this in like a right way, but think of something like what they wanted to tell here was that even though you're a good person, that doesn't necessarily mean you win, or like there are like a lot of ways to win, or is winning even a good thing? So that was what it was. So for instance, you open up to someone, but eventually you can die, right? If you trust somebody, you might die. Or even like, if you lie, you might win, or some like those kind of stories. I think that was what it was, not about like politics.
You know, Doug, that's actually what Sohyeon is saying is almost kind of refreshing. And I think what I miss about entertainment at this point, right? Remember when we talked about Ted Lasso earlier in the year, and it was like, this is a show that's kind of this classic sports show, this fish out of water with this ragtag team of misfits. And the importance of belief and team. And that's so much more appealing. And I think that's what Sohyeon's getting at, that maybe...
maybe it's not a social commentary on something. Yeah.
Thank God, in a way.
I don't know. Yeah. Maybe I don't know, because I've been here for a while.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, it could be, it could not be. I don't know. But I just find it humorous that everyone's initial reaction to anything is like, this is a social criticism of this issue that I have a problem with specifically, whereas maybe it's just a story about people in a interesting environment that hopefully could only exist in the fictional world.
And you know, in some ways, we're almost fortunate that it happened in 2021 instead of 2019. Otherwise, we'd have to read about how this is a reflection of Donald Trump, I suspect, with a lot of media.
I mean, yeah, probably.
Okay, now the other thing that I wrote down that I think is interesting about these games, and again, I'm glad that we have Sohyeon here. You know, Doug, you just kind of roll your eyes if this is going down a path of being too boring. But almost every one of these survival games or these games seems to have like these elements of social science in them, these elements of decision theory and game theory. And academics can't help when they watch these things to say, look, my research matters because I study this kind of group decision making or psychology or game theory. I think it's fascinating to watch, you know, and this comes up a lot in these kind of things. It's like, well, how do I form a team whenever there's voting on something? How do these things play out? Probability is like at the core of this game in some ways. The main character ends up destitute because he's gambling on horses. There's essentially a coin flipping game related to a bridge that Sohyeon mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of interesting. It's like social science and probability ends up kind of, you know, bore students to death on campus. But when it's behind the scenes of a survival game, I think people love this stuff.
I want to add that educational moment I had, or something that I realized they're going to use this in classrooms at business schools, was sunk cost theory. There was like a moment in the show where I don't know if half the participants in the game had already died. The people that were remaining were hungry, they were banged up, and they understood that almost all of them, if not all of them, were going to die for other people's entertainment. And they had the decision. They could opt out. They could leave on their own terms, survive, go back. And they decided that we've already had enough people die. We've made it this far. There's a lot of people who have paid a price. And therefore, the rational thing for us to do is to move forward in something that is clearly a very bad move. That was just like someone ignoring the sunk cost. Or I guess it was just a sunk cost fallacy in practice.
Yeah, I think that's a good one. And it's the way the game proceeds is as more people are eliminated as in died, the prize money increases. People involved in the game always have the option to, if they can vote as a majority, to end the game. And so it is this kind of this interesting decision theory and how people are actually going to move forward. And
it's clearly a social
is perfect for that.
It's clearly a social criticism of the U.S. voting system. I'll see myself.
What about you, Mike? What kind of theories did you thought of?
It's almost like on every game, you know, whenever they started to get into things like forming teams, all right, and they would do things on this game where they would form teams and then they would change the team. So people had to abandon others, right? And so there's this notion of, and again, maybe it's not that, it's more of an interesting thing to just sort of watch it play out, the dilemmas that people face, right? So there's this level of competition. There's also this set of constantly changing rules that put people in binds. And, you know, the audience that we're watching, like I said, when they're forming teams, it's like, well, you should be with your friend, but maybe you think your friend's going to be a weaker player. So now what's the cost of betraying your friend, forming a team with someone else, which, you know, I think ends up being part of all of these survival games.
What would you do? Would you form a team with a friend?
Well, I think this really came into play specifically. It's like the American public was really introduced to the word alliance via Survivor, right? And in Survivor, it was always, would you form an alliance? And then always this background of, are you going to betray the people in that alliance? And so it's not just like game theory or decision theory. These things almost have this like dynamic game theory operation going on in the background.
This is like a little bit of a different subject, but I was just going to note that when I was watching the show, I was pretty miserable. Like, I didn't enjoy watching it. I was sitting there just like, this is horrible. This is horrific.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And well, I was going to say, and yet every day, like during the day when my day was going on, I would find myself kind of like, can't wait to watch another episode tonight, like kind of itching for the next episode. Even now that the season's over, when it was done, I was like, all right, I'm never watching anything like that again. And I like think back about it all the time. And I'm like, man, I wonder what happens next. I wonder what happens in this second season that's going to come out. Can we talk about how like...
Doug, like, is that your reaction to a lot of these things, like Hunger Games or any of these?
No.
Just this one?
Yeah. It's just... but...
Well, let's stay there for a second.
There's like an addictive
quality. What do you think
quality.
It is?
There's something that keeps you coming back.
Is it because they took this to the extreme?
The amount of disturbing images. I don't like to sit around and watch disturbing things for hours at a time. And some movies might have one scene or two or shows that are a little bit disturbing. But Squid Game, it's probably 30 minutes out of every episode.
Well, you know, let's just for fun here. What was the most disturbing? I'm going to ask both of you this. What was your most disturbing? What was the thing that gave you the most visceral reaction? And I use that intentionally, this kind of physical reaction, because there was part of this that definitely got to me as well.
Now I got to reminisce on all of them.
Well, I'll start. Okay. And so at one point, one of the games, and this is the one that Sayon referred to as not a game they play, but it's an interesting game because essentially it's a coin toss game where to succeed in this game and not to die, you've got to flip 16 coins correct in a row. Okay. So it's a and when you do the math in your head, you kind of immediately go, oh, this is impossible.
Yeah.
But the thing about that, that it was a glass bridge. And if you, you know, if you guessed wrong, you fell through a glass tile to your death. That one got to me, you know, like almost created this physical reaction because, you know, standing on, even standing on glass high above the ground would be kind of terrifying. And then the fact that these panels are going to break, and this is all based on an impossible probability game, that one was probably the most intense reaction I had to anything happening.
Well, for me, it was green light, red light, because I did not expect that much of shooting.
Okay, so she... Red Light, Green Light is the game that's played in the very first episode, or perhaps it's the second episode, I'm not sure, but it's the first game they play.
And then that, that like, the doll, that doll standing in front of, like, the people starting to shoot, that character is actually on the textbook, you know? Like, so that character, that, like, a girl character with, like, rolling eyes, that character used to be on the textbook of the elementary school. So I was familiar of that character, and then that girl starts shooting, and then I'm like, oh, my gosh.
And then I'm really glad we have you. So when they're playing Red Light, Green Light, they have essentially an automated girl that is announcing Red Light, Green Light, and Sayun's making the point that that doll is shaped like something that was on the
textbook.
The kids,
like, textbooks. A character the textbook. Yeah.
Okay. And they're practically on a playground in most of these events where people are being murdered. And so, in mass, but yeah, I would say for me, there was a lot of that. I did think this is where I say, like, I think the show was very successful at doing what, because that scene in particular, it had been a slow beginning of the series, and you're kind of saying, where is this going? And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, you've got people getting murdered left and right, and it's so jarring and it's so disturbing, and that's exactly the effect that they wanted, I think. But for me, I think, you know, watching them, what were they selling, organs from people, organ harvesting or something, when people were still partially alive. That was pretty disturbing.
Well,
I might
that
have
was,
covered my
and what was great about that part is it purely gratuitous, right? Did it really advance the story? It was
no. That's what,
like,
I was like, why is this here? Why do I have to watch this? Why do honestly, if it was just like competitions and there's people dying, falling off a bridge or whatever, like that gets where it's kind of like the Hunger Games. But they went to every extreme to make you feel unsettled.
Yeah, and again, that's probably a great word for the background on all of this is, you know, maybe the additional element to Squid Game that's been missing in a lot of these other things is a real emphasis on making the audience feel unsettled. So it's almost adding that adrenaline surge that people will get with horror to this
right.
standard genre. Okay, Sayun, I want to ask you one last very Korean-specific question. Okay, so a lot of entertainment property success is driven by celebrity fandom. Okay, now this was interesting to me because this is the, like I said, the biggest show in the history of Netflix. I don't know a single one of the actors, you know, going into this. No one is recognizable. From a Korean's perspective, what is the, you know, is this driven by celebrity? Are these famous actors? Are these really appealing people that really get the audience excited?
Yeah, actually, the guy who appears in the first episode, I don't even know how much I can, like, spoil, so I'm trying to not do that. Yeah. But then the guy, I don't remember the character name, but his name is Lee Jung-jae. So 456.
Four, five, six.
456. So he is super duper famous in Korea.
Well, you know what? Just a small, I don't mean to interrupt, but what a great maybe accident that happened in all of this. For international audiences that maybe can't pronounce the names and have trouble remembering the names, they all the characters had numbers as well. So I think of that guy as 456.
Yeah, so 456 actually hit. He is known for being this like a super attractive actor. And we all Koreans know him. And I actually saw the interview. Like one person, I think it was an American reporter, asked him, like, how do you feel becoming a very famous person all in a sudden? And then he goes, well, in America, yes. Because he can't just walk around in the street in Korea because we all recognize him. It's like that.
So he's is a it Korean. Like...
So he's a Korean superstar.
Yeah, he is a superstar, yeah.
So is it like if Leonardo DiCaprio or Matthew McConaughey starred in the equivalent American show?
Yeah, exactly. It's like that, yeah.
Beyond the main character, was it sort of star-filled? I mean, it's an interesting show. You mentioned the masks. So you don't see a lot of people are not recognizable.
Mike, I was one of the extras. I was one of those guys in a mask for the show.
Yeah, only the contestants reveal their faces, right? Yeah, another person is Park Hae-soo. I don't remember his number, but the Seoul National University guy, Mike, that you mentioned, that guy is also famous.
That's player 218, I believe.
He was a good actor. I mean, they all were really good performances across the board, except the white guys, but I think they were intentionally that way. I'll say it. I actually do think it was like kind of a satire, like making a point, like the fact that we know the players' numbers and not their names. I think that was like, I think that was intentional. Like, these people aren't viewed as people, but anyway, just side note.
And then the lady from the North Korea, she is a very famous model. So,
okay. And so they really did a nice job constructing this. I mean, a lot of human interest, competition, celebrities. And I don't know how this went in terms of how the success happened. Did this pop initially in Korea and then people started to gravitate towards it and the hype machine started to roll and it just spread through all of Netflix? I mean, Netflix is also interesting in terms of fandom, right? Because everything is driven by an algorithm. And so I suspect my kids are watching almost everything Netflix shows them. Mm-hmm. And then that sort of gets into the general population and really takes off. I mean, the lessons for Netflix in this are probably tremendous as well.
Yeah, for sure. Without Netflix, I don't think this could have been this successful. But then as, because I was here, I'm not sure what like started first, but for sure, Koreans even got interested in this more because they realized that this show was going viral overseas meaning outside the Korea, right? So mm-hmm. I thought that was interesting too.
Oh, does this actually almost end up being like a point of pride that Korean culture is now dominating the globe, including the U.S.?
Well, of course, Koreans are proud, but we also know that, we're not dominating the world with all these shows, right?
Well, for a moment, right?
We think this is, an opportunity. Mm-hmm. Now, people outside Korea know that Koreans can produce something interesting. And then we've had that for a long time. It was just that it didn't go viral overseas. So
I have a question for both of you as marketing minds. In the music industry, stuff like, for example, Eminem will get in a lawsuit with the FCC, or NWA will have the FBI after them, and it will be publicized that your children should not listen to this because it's so bad. The things that they say are so bad and explicit that it's harmful. This is the devil's music. This is blah, blah, blah. Marilyn Manson is kind of the classic example of that and becomes a phenomenon. Do we think that there's an element of shock in this show that causes it to go viral, where people say, don't watch this show. It's the most insane thing you've ever seen. You do not let your children watch this show. Do not let your teenagers watch this show. And the teenagers are seeing this. Do we think that, like, from a marketing aspect, do we think part of the intentionally disturbing elements of the show helped it gain such viral exposure across the world?
I mean, I'll answer in two ways. First off, Doug, if you want the classic example of that, look up Two Live Crew in the 90s and their fight with Tipper Gore. This idea of, like, being explicit and how that creates hype and buzz around it. I struggle with, I think absolutely there's definitely a strategy in terms of being shocking and getting people to be interested because it's shocking. What I don't know about now is I feel like that game has changed, where it used to be, you know, things were PG-13 or they were rated R. But I think with the advent of streaming services, that now everyone is watching everything. And when I think about, you know, as you were going down that path, and I think about, like, my 17-year-old watching Squid Games, you know, look, my oldest son actually teaches fourth graders. And they play Squid Game on the playground now.
That's terrifying.
Okay. And so one of the things about Netflix is that almost everyone can watch, and smartphones, is people, the amount of parental control has really dropped precipitously in the last few years.
I know. And then even Mike texted me while he was watching the show. He was like, "Are you old enough to watch this?"
Well, right.
I don't think you're ever old enough to watch this.
It's not, like, great for kids to watch this.
Yeah, just to be clear. Yeah. Do not recommend for the children out there.
Okay, guys, last thing I want to go into is kind of always a fundamental question. So sports fandom, where we spend most of our time, is long-lasting. It's enduring. Doug Battle is a Georgia Bulldogs fan, and he's going to be a Georgia Bulldogs fan until the day he dies. Guarantee it. Entertainment fandom tends to be a little bit more fleeting. You know, there are some folks that were Beatles fans back in the day, and they're still Beatles fans. For something like this, a clear worldwide phenomena, is this enduring? They're talking about a second season of this. Second season is probably going to be very different in terms of the dynamics of the way the game works and the way the main character is going to function. Is this enduring? Are long-lasting fans created? Does 456 have fans?
456 has fans in Korea.
But as 456, does he have fans?
Oh, as a character.
Yeah.
I'm going to say I think it'll have a cult following that follows it religiously for as long as the show goes. But I also think a lot of people that watched the first season were watching it because of its popularity, because of the phenomena, and that tends to die down. I think 13 Reasons Why was a series like that, where it was huge in the US and you would hear about it and hear how controversial it was, and people would watch that first season, and by the time the third or fourth, I don't remember how many seasons they had, you know, maybe half or a third as many people were actually keeping up with it. So I think it goes both ways.
I think it is possible. So I'm not a fan of, like, 456, but, like, I saw a movie, like a Spanish show. It was called Money Heist. And there were some characters in there, like, let's say, like, Tokyo, that lady. I really became a fan of her. And then I never knew her before watching the show. But then later on, like I am keep on waiting for that show because I'm so, like, interested in those characters. So I think it is possible. But the thing is that with the characters in this show, they weren't, like, super attractive, you know, because they, like, the first reason they got into the game was because they were kind of losers in the society, right? There were nowhere for them to go but to just go into this game and then get the money, right? And then, so I don't know how this is going to play out for this show and, like, 456. What do you guys think?
Well, it's interesting too, right? And that, you know, one of the things you do in a lot of entertainment properties is you build up these characters and then you can have sequels built around those characters. In a survival game, you know, Survivor is kind of remarkable to be in the 40 some 40 some odd seasons. Here, what is the point of continuation?
It's a new cast.
It's a new cast. It's a new game. Does the game get boring over time? Do they have to keep, Doug, to your point about how intense this was, do they have to keep upping the standards on the game? They have to keep getting crazier in the mayhem?
I thought they were going to have egg toss at some point. I thought that would be really intense.
Well, like one of the stories that I heard, I don't even know if this is true or not, but like if you remember the show, like people who organize the game, they all wear something in red. And at the end, 4, 5, 6 dyes his hair in red, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe that means something. That's what people are thinking. So maybe he now becomes organizer. I don't know what's going to happen. Or he goes into the system, try to break the system. So maybe that could be another story.
Yeah, and maybe to wrap this up, and I hadn't anticipated going in this direction, maybe to wrap this up, this whole thing is kind of interesting to me. So in this end conversation, Doug, you mentioned, 13 Reasons? Is that that's the suicide show, right?
13 Reasons Why. Yeah, it's about suicide.
And Cy Young, you mentioned Money Heist, I think it was called. And it's kind of funny. My daughter was watching that a few years ago, and she didn't know how to pronounce heist. And she would, Dad, you got to watch Money Heist. But it does... You know, maybe the end point on this, and you guys can each make a couple of comments, because I don't really know where this goes, that this highlights something about this current entertainment business model of companies like Netflix, of this idea of their, a lot of this is algorithm generated, right? It's like, so Cy Young watched Money Heist. I watched Money Heist because my daughter was getting recommended Money Heist. I know that 13 Reasons was an enormous show, so the algorithm was putting that out there for just about everyone. Netflix also has this kind of strange issue of, are they able to create these long-term properties? I mean, does Netflix have any shows that you really associate with the Netflix platform? Like, let's say, The Mandalorian on something like Disney Plus.
I'd say Stranger Things. Is the one to me.
What'd you say, Doug? Sorry.
Stranger Things. That's like the Netflix show that I like would say is the equivalent to The Mandalorian.
And so part of me wonders is like this kind of, you know, in some ways it's easy for them to get hype because you just sort of put it out there, whether it's Tiger King, 13 Reasons, or Squid Games, and you can get everyone watching it the way the recommendation engines work. But do they really build, let's say, long-term sustainability? And so Stranger Things, Doug, you mentioned that. Is Stranger Things still ongoing?
Yeah, and they're about to release, I think, 2022, a fourth season. It's still got a bunch of fans. I recently went to like a Stranger Things pop-up shop, and they recreated a lot of the scenes and had you go through it and stuff. And they were selling T-shirts and merch and stuff. People still dress up as the characters for Halloween every year. I think that one's lasting. Again, I think the challenge for Squid Game is the fact that whereas Stranger Things, you had a first season that established some characters, and over the second and third seasons, you had a bad character turn good and became one of the fan favorites, and you had all this character development. There's really only one character that lasts through the first season. Spoiler alert. But, you know, I don't know how you continue with just one lasting character. I don't know how you build from that, reestablish a whole new batch of characters, reintroduce them and their circumstances and their stories. Seems like that would get repetitive. So they definitely face a challenge with this show that Stranger Things did not face, that The Mandalorian did not face on Disney Plus.
Sayan, any thoughts?
No, I agree with Doug. It is hard because, like what Doug said, only one character survived at the end, and how they come up with something interesting that's not pretty repetitive, it's going to be not easy.
I could almost say there's a fundamental brand equity lesson in this. They develop these wonderful storylines, build up the brand equity, the value of each of these characters, and then they harvest all this brand equity and have to start over.
I mean, if we're doing a...
Is this really about like characters, or what is it about like the fandom? Is it about the game? What is it, right? Mm-hmm. Is it about the series or like the system or the message? What is it? So I think that matters.
Yeah.
Okay. And so to put a punctuation mark on this, you know, we've talked about the Squid Game today. I think we all have, unlike the universal acclaim this thing got, I think all three of us enjoyed it. I think Doug enjoyed it a little bit less. I think we all found it tremendously interesting. And so if you're looking for the binge watch, Squid Game is definitely something out there. And it's also something that's interesting to watch from perspective of the business of fandom, right? You know, how is this fandom created? How is this, and even is the Squid Game fandom sustainable moving on? Hope you enjoyed the episode. As always, more content at www.fandomanalytics.com. Thanks.